Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte likes to be on top. So when we find ourselves on the bottom, it is like a body blow. And that's what it felt like in 2014 when the Land of Opportunity study conducted by Harvard University's Raj Chetty revealed that we ranked 50th out of 50 cities for economic mobility. Essentially, the study showed that if a child was born into poverty here, rising above that situation was extremely difficult, if not impossible. Well, that didn't sit well. So government, business, faith, and philanthropic leaders swung into action. Money was raised, programs were designed and implemented to rectify this blemish on Charlotte. Much has been done, and this summer a new Chetty study was released showing things are improving. This time we ranked 38th out of 50. But almost as soon as the champagne corks began to fly, we were hit with a sobering realization. This new study might not be an apples-to-apples comparison with the old, which left some wondering if all the money and the effort that we poured into increasing economic opportunities were actually working, or if the improvements the study reveals connects our progress to something else. What better way to find out and to understand both the original and this new study than to go to the source? And we have the source with us. Raj Chetty is a professor of economics at Harvard University and director of Opportunity Insights. And also with us is Sherry Chisholm, executive director of Leading on Opportunity. That's an organization that formed as a result of the initial study to address economic inequality. Welcome back to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mike.
More to be here. So I'm going to begin with you, Raj, because I think it would be beneficial for our listeners who may not be terribly familiar with all of this, because we have new people coming to the city all the time, to talk about the original Land of Opportunity study for a moment. What did it show?
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. So back in 2014, our team used anonymized data on 20 million kids and their parents growing up in the U.S., drawn from tax records, to ask a very simple question. If you were born into poverty, into a low-income family, what were your chances of rising up into the middle class or beyond and achieving the American dream of upward mobility? I think something we all aspire to. It's one of the cornerstone ideals of America. And we had enough data that for the very first time, we were able to measure that statistic, not just in the nation as a whole, but city by city, county by county, across the entire United States. And we put out that data publicly. And one of the things that was apparent in the data is that if you looked at the biggest cities in America, there were vast differences in children's chances of rising up. There were some places, for example, Salt Lake City, Utah, or other cities where you had very good chances of rising up if you were born into poverty. There were other cities, like Charlotte in particular, and Atlanta as well, where if you were born to a low-income family, you had very poor chances of rising out of poverty. And as you noted, turned out in the data, that for kids born in the late 1970s, early 1980s, which was the generation we were able to study in that initial work, Charlotte was the place where it was hardest to climb up out of poverty out of the largest American cities.
Well, I think Atlanta was 49th. We were 50th. I don't know that I've ever asked this question. Who was number one?
Number one was Salt Lake City, which I mentioned
okay.
earlier.
So how big a spread? I don't think I've ever asked this question. How big a spread was there between Salt Lake City, number one, and Charlotte, number 50?
There's quite a large spread. So in Charlotte, odds are if you're born to a family in poverty in the bottom fifth of the income distribution, you have a pretty low chance of making it to the middle class or the top of the income distribution. In Salt Lake City, it's not like everyone makes it to the top. But you have a reasonable chance. You know, there's a pretty good chance you're going to make it into the middle class. Some kids remain trapped in poverty in the next generation. It's quite a meaningful difference between.
Now, I've only been to Salt Lake City's airport, so I've never been to the city itself. But I'm going to wager that there's a big demographic racial difference in the population in Salt Lake City, and maybe even an economic class difference in Salt Lake City than there is in Charlotte. We'll get into that as we go along here. But a few years after this original study came out, And we were working to respond to the deficiencies that we saw in ourselves in that study. Additional data released indicated that perhaps things weren't as bad as we originally thought they were. At least that's my impression. And we did a program on this many years ago, too. This was because the original study indicated that one of the biggest predictors of higher mobility, upward mobility, is two-parent households. And at the time, Mecklenburg County had one of the lowest marriage rates in the country. And as I remember it, that information was not included in the original study. If that's true, why not? And how does that statistic influence our interpretation of those findings?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the way I look at it is I would separate two different points. The first is just, what is your chance of rising up, independent of whether you're growing up in a two-parent family, single-parent family, what the family structure in the area looks like, other factors, and so on. Just straight in the data, take the set of kids who are growing up in families, say in the bottom 20% of the income distribution, what fraction of them make it out of poverty? We can just calculate that number. I think, Charlotte, it is a fact, and I think that fact still holds, and we stand by it, that for the kids born in the late 1970s, early 1980s, it was unfortunately one of the cities where it was hardest to rise up. Now, in subsequent work and other related work by ourselves and other scholars, many people have used the data that we put out publicly to ask, what are the factors that are strongly predictive of these differences in economic mobility across areas? Why is it that Charlotte has a much lower rates of upward mobility than other places? And you do see, as you noted, that factors like the fraction of two-parent households, marriage rates essentially, are very highly predictive at a community level of rates of upward mobility. So I think that does not contradict the original fact about rates of upward mobility. You know, I think there's no fundamental tension between those two things. Things have changed in Charlotte over time, and we'll get into that. But that's how I see those pieces fitting together.
In this latest study, has the number of single-parent households changed in Mecklenburg County, or is that still a stumbling block?
Yeah, so I was just looking at the data. So just as a bit of context for listeners, the latest study that our team just put out a few months ago essentially updates the 2014 study that we were talking about mm-hmm. a minute ago by using data that's essentially available because of the gift of time. A decade has passed. More kids have grown up. We can see how much they're earning in adulthood. We can now look at how economic mobility has changed over the past 15 generations or so in Charlotte as people are entering the labor force. And we're seeing some progress in Charlotte in terms of that statistic of your chances of rising out of poverty. We are not seeing a tremendous change. I was just looking at the data last night in Mecklenburg County in the share of two-parent households. That doesn't seem to be a major factor that's changing significantly. That's not to say that it doesn't matter, but in this particular case, it's not changing very dramatically relative to other places.
Sherry Chisholmuth with us. She is the executive director of Leading on Opportunity, one of the organizations that was founded as a result of this original Chetty study to address the problems that it uncovered. Sherry, you're on the ground in this. What do you think the impact of single-family households is on what the folks you're working with and the problems you're working to address with regard to upward mobility?
When we think about the work first, thank you for having me, Mike. It's always a pleasure to get to speak with Raj about the work that we're doing here in Charlotte. When we think about what's happening here in Charlotte, I think there are a constellation of things that have taken place. But what's most important in that constellation is thinking about how Charlotte has grown or evolved over the course of the past few years, which impacts the results that we're seeing now. And so when we think about two-parent households, that's certainly one factor, but what we have chosen to focus on at Leading on Opportunity are what we know to be the primary determinants of economic mobility. So child and family stability, early care and education, social capital, and the impact of segregation. Those are things that we know that we can control or influence at a systematic level. So we choose to focus there as opposed to what's happening in someone's individual home or their personal life.
Okay. And now, although, Raj, Charlotte really took this to heart, because as I said, I'm not exaggerating when I said it was like a body blow at the beginning of the program. It was, and we have, you can count on both hands and more the number of organizations and efforts that sprang from this study. And I can't count the dollars that are being put into this because I can't count that high. So we are making concerted efforts to address this. But one of the things about Charlotte in this study that I'd like to get an answer to is the fact that we took it to heart in Charlotte, but it wasn't just about the city of Charlotte. It wasn't even just about Mecklenburg County. You took into account what is called the Charlotte Commuter Zone, which extends as far as Rowan County in North Carolina and Chester County in South Carolina. And I would wager there are a lot of people out there who don't think that those areas are Charlotte proper. And it compared us to Atlanta and to Pittsburgh with distinctly different characteristics, both geographically and in terms of population. Were those fair comparisons?
Yeah, great question. You know, anytime you make comparisons like this, there's a choice of how you define a city. How do you think about a city? Is it just the city proper? Is it the broader metro area? And for different questions, for different people, you know, there can be different notions of what comparisons are appropriate. What I would suggest is that if you, I would invite listeners to go to a website, opportunityatlas.org, where you can freely look at these data yourself. You can look at Mecklenburg County. You can look at specific zip codes. You can look at broader areas. And what you see, Mike, I think is a very clear pattern where you're right that the statistics we quote, 50th out of 50, that was at what we considered the metro area level. Basically, just to be clear on how that geographic unit is being chosen, what you call the commuter zone, it's based on commuting flows. So prior work has used data on where people are driving basically to work to try to divide places into separate labor markets. And so similarly in Atlanta, it's not literally the county that contains the city of Atlanta, it was the broader metro area being used in that comparison. Now that said, if you just zoom in on Mecklenburg County and you just zoom in on Fulton County with Atlanta, you see very similar results to what we see for the broader metro area. So these phenomena are occurring at a broader level, but they absolutely are occurring very clearly in Mecklenburg County itself.
And I would take it the same would be true of Allegheny County, which is where Pittsburgh is, correct?
Yes. Yes.
This new study has been released now, and it shows that we moved up from 50th to 38th. And in fact, economic mobility in Charlotte increased at the third highest rate in the country in this interval between your original study and this new study. The original study looked at children born between in the late 70s, early 80s. The new one looks at children born in about 1992. We were also the only jurisdiction in the country, according to your study, where poor white children experienced no decline in economic mobility. All this good news on the face of it. What is the significance, however, of the finding that white children here experienced no economic decline between 1980 and 1992?
Yeah, so there, I think the broader context in the nation is extremely important. So what we're finding more broadly in this study is that economic mobility is declining for white Americans growing up in low-income families. So if you were born into poverty, your odds of rising up have fallen in the US quite significantly as a white child relative to back in the late 1970s. Relative to that, being in the same place as where Charlotte was in 1978, relative to that broader benchmark, that is a good thing, that is exceptional relative to the rest of the country. Now, obviously, we would like to be making progress and not just stay in the same place, but it's important to recognize the broader macroeconomic trends as well.
I'd like to add something here, Mike, if you're okay with that.
You got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
The primary takeaway for me is that this is not a zero-sum game. I think that that has been part of the conversation or rhetoric that was created, that if you focus on the most marginalized and other folks lose out. But what we see in Raj's research is that's just not true. And it's really important as we continue the work as a collective moving forward.
We'll come back to that in a moment. Sherry Chisholm is leading on Opportunity. Raj Chetty of the Chetty Study. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Raj Chetty is with us. He's a professor of economics at Harvard University and director of Opportunity Insights, also the leader of the Land on Opportunity study, which shook the city to its core when it was released several years ago, and the new study, which shows some improvement. Sherry Chisholm has been working on that improvement, among other organizations. She's the executive director of Leading on Opportunity. Just prior to the break, you were talking about these statistics that I cited, that Charlotte increased at the third highest rate in the country in the interval between these two studies in terms of economic mobility, and the only jurisdiction in the country where white children experienced no decline in economic mobility. And you were talking about the misperception, Chisholm, Sherry, that this is a zero-sum game, and it is not. I wanted to give you a chance to fully expand on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's particularly important when we look at in Charlotte, who is most disenfranchised, and that it is a result of the impact of slavery. If you look at, you know, the maps that Raj and his team created, those communities that were in the bottom quartile were all represented in the Southeast, where we know slavery was most prevalent. And those are the same communities that have struggled to achieve the economic mobility that they want and deserve. I think what Raj's most recent study shows us is that you can focus on serving those populations, and at the same time, others also benefit. And I just think that's an important message to make clear as we necessarily continue this work as a collective community moving forward. And I know Raj also wanted to add something.
And before he does, would I be right in saying that it's not just slavery, it's Jim Crow, it's a redlining, it's lack of
other opportunities?
Absolutely.
From slavery to Jim Crow to redlining that very much so existed here to restrictive deeds, Black Americans were not allowed to buy property, or there were very strict regulations around what that looked like. And that still remains in our country. One of the primary ways to build wealth is through home ownership. And so what Raj's research shows us is the impact of those restrictive or corrupt policies and how we need to continue to address them.
Raj, did you want to add to that before we move on?
Yeah. I absolutely agree with everything Sherry says there, especially the point about this not being a zero-sum game. And I just want to add some context zooming out from Charlotte that I think underscores that point, which is that we find that the places where Black Americans are making the most progress. So what we find, Mike, more generally is you talked about how for white Americans, economic mobility is declining. For Black Americans, more generally in the U.S., we're seeing some progress, lower chances of remaining trapped in poverty in the next generation, higher levels of economic mobility. And very interestingly and importantly, the places where you're seeing the most progress for Black Americans are the places where things deteriorated the least for low-income white Americans. So in other words, when one group is doing better, the other group is also doing relatively better. You should not think of this as one group's success is coming at the expense of the other. And I think that's extremely important to understand, that this is not sort of a fixed pie, you know, who gets a slice of the pie, zero-sum game. This is about everybody making progress together. And so, Charlotte is lucky to be in a position where it's been positive on both of those dimensions in recent years.
Well, I was just going to ask, if the study indicates that we are the only jurisdiction in the country where the economic opportunities for white children experienced no decline, does that mean things are static for African-American and other poor children who are non-white, or that they are also increasing in their economic prospects?
So actually, you know, Charlotte does relatively well compared to other places for white kids, and it also does relatively well compared to other places for Black kids. So in particular, what that means is Black children and Black men in particular, and in Mecklenburg County in particular, are experiencing significantly better outcomes than they were back in the, for the kids born in the late 1970s.
Do we know why?
Yeah, so let me talk about why in a second, but I want to underscore one caveat to that, which is we're seeing a higher chance of escaping poverty in Mecklenburg County. So you see fewer kids who were born to the poorest families remaining, you know, out of work, incarcerated, some of the toughest outcomes. That's less likely to happen. However, if you were to think of upward mobility as reaching, say, the upper middle class or reaching the top of the income distribution, much less progress on that front. So I want to be clear that while progress is happening, it's nowhere close to saying, you know, we're coming close to racial equity or that we've got the level of opportunity that we might aspire to.
I want to get back to something I said at the very beginning, that maybe this is not an apples-to-apples comparison, this comparison between the original study and the latest study, because the original study looked at children born in the in 1980, around that time period. The new study looks at children born in 1992. So how do we know that there has been improvement. These are two different generations of children in two different time periods. Mm-hmm. Is it just that things have improved overall economically because Charlotte's continuing to grow and prosper over time? Or is it something that we're doing for individuals today that we didn't do in 1980? What's the reason?
Yeah, great question. So first, I would stress that we work hard to make an apples-to-apples comparison just from a pure statistical point of view. We try to do exactly the same thing in terms of how we measure things for kids born in the late 1970s as we do for kids born in the early 1990s. And so in a strict sense, we're really just calculating the same exact statistics, same exact data, and saying, how does it look? Now, how you interpret that is tricky because, as you note, obviously you've got kids born in different generations. They also mechanically are going to be entering the labor market in different time periods. The kids born in the late 1970s were measuring incomes when kids are in their late 20s, which is when things settle down. People have finished going to college, maybe graduate school. You start to get a more reliable picture of their permanent income once they're 27 or so. And so, if you think about the kids born in the late 1970s, we're measuring their incomes around 2005. For the kids born in 1992, we're measuring their incomes right before the pandemic in 2019. So those are two different periods. And so you're right to ask, Mike, is it about the difference in the time period, or is it about something that changed for these kids who were growing up more recently versus earlier? And so let me give you a few pieces of data that strongly suggest to us that it's not just about changes in the economy or changes in the time period of measurement. One, if you look at things that have nothing to do with the economy directly, so for instance, high school graduation rates or SAT scores, these are things that are not obviously directly affected by the state of Charlotte's economy at a given point in time. You see the exact same patterns where kids from low-income families now in Charlotte are more likely to graduate from high school. They're doing better on the SAT if they took the test. On various indicators that are not directly about jobs, you're seeing that same form of progress, which strongly suggests that it's something deeper.
Well, that I have to ask this question then, because the improvement that we see in the young people who were born in 1980 versus the young people born in 1992 and what they're earning and their economic prospects having improved, all of that predates any efforts that Charlotte has made to improve things, which came out of the first study, because the 1992 young people had already shown improvement prior to our even knowing the 1980 results. So how do we measure this? What do we take from this, Raj? And I'll get your impression too, Sherry.
Yeah, so first on timing, that's absolutely right. So a lot of these changes predate the current initiatives that Leading on Opportunity and others have been focused on in Charlotte. Let me say two things on that. So first, what's driving it in a mechanical sense? As you note, it can't literally be the initiatives that were implemented in the late 2010s, after the original study came out. So if we look at the data, again, we find it useful to zoom out beyond the case of Charlotte itself to learn more broadly about what's driving these changes. And I think that's going to apply to Charlotte itself. What we find is that the strongest driver of these changes in economic mobility are changes in the adults' employment rates and parents' employment rates in the communities where these kids were growing up. So in cities where Black parents had higher employment rates over time, you see their children doing significantly better in terms of their chances of rising up. And importantly, Mike, this is not just about whether your own parents have a job, which obviously could be helpful. This is again about the community level, holding fixed your own parents' employment status. If you're growing up in a community where more folks in your social community are working, you do better in the long run. Now, Charlotte, turns out, is a place where Black folks in particular, if you look at Black employment rates, they've been on a positive trend relative to many other places. And it's possible that that has cascaded down and had a positive impact in the next generation, which predates, of course, these new efforts.
Sherry, I want to get your take on this, because we've had, as a result of that first study, Charlotte literally sprang into action, and your organization exists because of the efforts that we put into this, and we put countless dollars into this. Just to name a few of the other organizations working to improve economic opportunity, Project Lift, the Mayor's Racial Equity Initiative, the Housing Trust Fund, Road to Hire, the Charlotte Opportunity Initiative, the Charlotte Leadership Council, and of course your organization Leading on Opportunity, all doing great work. But particularly if you were formed after this Land of Opportunity study, do you feel like you're working in the dark? I mean, can you use the study? Can you use the second study or the improvements indicated in that study as some sort of yardstick upon which to measure your success?
I appreciate this question so much. I want to come back to something you said earlier about it being a gut punch. It was a gut punch for folks who were not living in the conditions that Raj Chetty lifted up. For folks who either were experiencing poverty, who were birthed out of poverty, or who were working in nonprofits or human services, they knew that this existed. It was a microphone to what so many folks in the community had not had the space to be heard. And so as much as we're using the language economic mobility now because of Raj's research or because of Leading on Opportunity, our community has been doing this work for generations. You know, the work that is represented in Raj's most recent study is reflective of work that happened in the 90s and early 2000s, well before Leading on Opportunity was established. And I say that proudly because it's evidence of how focused Charlotte has been on creating a community that grows and grows equitably. So if we think about what was happening even in the 80s, we transitioned really well from a textile mill community to one of banking, which gave us the skills and chops to then weather the recession of the early 2000s well, where we now can say that we have banking, finance, healthcare, fintech, and a growing hospitality industry. Having a concentrated focus over generations is something we'll need to continue to do, along with a robust nonprofit community that continues to evolve how we serve our neighbors here in Charlotte very well. And so I want to make sure that it's clear that this has always been is what Charlotte has been about. And then in 2014, it was a surge into the work that we need to continue doing. As Raj lifted up, his data shows us that we're not close to economic equity or even equality for that matter. So we have a ton more work to do. And I just appreciate, yes, the data that he puts out because it gives us the momentum and additional tools to continue on that path.
So what I'm hearing you say, and I know Raj wants to jump into this, what I'm hearing you say is that we were already doing things to improve economic opportunity, and this study gave us a shot in the arm to amp it up. And so things that we were already doing perhaps led us to having better outcomes in 1992 than we did in 1980. And now this effort, which has been millions and millions of dollars and lots of programs, can only help. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. My goal is that we see the evidence of what we're doing today in my three-year-old daughter's life 30 years from now. So the seeds we plant today, we will experience in generations to come.
Raj.
Well, it's great to hear Sherry talk about that background that preceded Leading an Opportunity that I think was going very much the same direction. That has been my impression from looking at the data, that there were trends in Charlotte that were going in a positive direction even prior to that 2014 study, and had that impression partly from just the reception to the 2014 study, right? I think one could have reacted to that study by saying, oh, you know, is that data really right? Charlotte's doing very well. Are we really 50th out of 50? I was very impressed by the fact that the community came together. And as you pointed out, Mike, you know, really focused on saying, okay, how can we move this forward? And I think that's reflective of the fact that there's been an interest in those issues in Charlotte going back further in time, as Sherry underscores. And I suspect that that's part of the reason where we're seeing these gains. That was not, you know, to be clear, the type of response we got from a number of other cities. So I do think there's something distinctive about Charlotte, and that's great.
I don't know that this question has been asked, and I don't know whether you can answer it, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Raj, because this study looks at two different generations, and the 1992 generation have better economic prospects than the 80 generation. But I'm curious if those kids born in 1980, who are around 44 years old today, have also experienced better economic prospects because the city as a whole has gotten wealthier.
Great question. So we have not directly looked at that in the data, but our sense is a lot of what's changing here is across birth cohorts, so meaning across these different groups of kids born at different points in time, rather than just changes in trajectory for a given set of kids. And data that we have that I think supports that point is if you look at a given set of kids and follow them over time and ask, you know, have their chances of rising up changed as we just track a given generation over time, we don't see very significant changes relative to the changes we're seeing across generations. And fundamentally, that's because the key drivers of these differences in economic mobility appear to be the environments in which children are growing up, and sort of what you bring to the table in terms of human capital and social capital when you're entering the labor market. It seems much less about how does the economy happen to be doing at the moment, who's hiring, which jobs are available. It's more about how well are you set up in terms of the education you got and all of the different factors that Sherry has pointed out that you all are focused on.
Life's a roller coaster, so I'm wondering if we can extrapolate from this that since things improved between 80 and 92, what would happen to children who were born in 2004, which were 12 years after the 92 kids were born? Would their prospects also have improved, or do you know?
Yeah, so hard to know. The challenge in studying economic mobility is you always are stuck in this position of people would like more recent data for the kids, you know, growing up today. Of course, you can't see that until they actually grow up and you see their incomes in adulthood. As an economist, I hate to make predictions because economists are notoriously bad at making predictions and are always shown to be wrong afterward. But from the data we have, things like test scores that I was mentioning earlier, that you can see a little bit earlier, right? Like how are kids doing on the SAT? We're seeing these trends continuing. I would also add that the fact that there's this real initiative in Charlotte led by Sherry and a number of others to actually make a difference on economic mobility, our sense is they're working on a lot of the factors that seem from the science very important. We would think that this is going to have an impact going forward. So my guess will be we continue to see progress, but, you know, of course, no guarantees.
Sherry, what are you seeing on the ground?
We have received similar questions, and I think what we learned from the response to Raj's data is that our community wants more data. And so Raj's studies thus far have been longitudinal, looking in the past. In response to that, those insights he's created, we've created the Opportunity Compass. So it is a tool by which we produce leading indicators of progress on a 2 to 3 year clip to address the very question that you just asked. So what data is publicly available to us that is it's Mecklenburg specific, that tells us across the determinants of economic mobility if we're trending in a positive or negative direction. And then we're able to pair that with practices on the ground that speak to how we can continue to make improvements both as funders and as nonprofits committed to the work.
We're talking about the Leading on Opportunity study and the progress that Charlotte has made in the intervening years, and we'll do more in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. WFAE and WFHE, I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Chetty study with Raj Chetty himself. It's the Land of Opportunity study conducted by Harvard University's Opportunity Insights several years ago, which was like a bomb going off in this community, to which we responded. And one of the many organizations that has sprung up to respond to the economic findings is Leading on Opportunity, which is now run by Sherry Chisholm. She's the executive director. You can go online, and I think you just mentioned this, Raj, a few seconds ago, to opportunityatlas.org, which is a collaboration between Opportunity Insights at Harvard and the U.S. Census Bureau. And when you do, you can look at various maps. You find that in 1978, most of the South, including us, is red, indicating low incomes. And when you switch to changes in income, those red counties now switch to blue, indicating economic growth. And counties that were blue in some cases have since turned red, showing slower economic growth. Does that really tell us anything other than that income levels balanced out over time?
So, Mike, one of the patterns you see in the data, as you noted, is that a lot of the places that had the lowest levels of economic mobility ended up doing better and catching up a bit to the places that were better back in 1978. Initially, we thought, oh, is this just sort of a pattern of reversion to the mean where places that start out with low levels of economic mobility just catch up to the average. But that's clearly not the case. To give you a concrete example, take Atlanta, which we discussed before, ranked 49th out of 50 in our original study. Now, in Atlanta, there's been essentially no change in economic mobility over the same 15 years, but we're seeing significant progress in Charlotte. So there's by no means a guarantee that if you start out at the bottom in terms of economic mobility, you're automatically going to spring up. Likewise, there are some places at the top. Salt Lake City was number one back in 78. It remains number one now. There are other places like Philadelphia that have deteriorated quite significantly in terms of economic prospects. So the pattern you're noticing in those maps at a broad level is correct, but there's lots of variation around that. And the main factor we find to be highly predictive are changes in the parental employment rates in the community. That really seems to be the key.
And your original study didn't break till the 1980 group of children. It didn't break the 1980 group of children out by race. Let's put it that way. Charlotte came in 50th. Pittsburgh was second. Pittsburgh is one of the whitest metro areas in the country, if I understand this correctly. And if you use the Opportunity Atlas, which does allow you to break down counties by race, you find that a black child born in Allegheny County, which is the home county of Pittsburgh, to low-income families in 1978 had expected earnings of $18,000, while a black child born in that same year in Mecklenburg County was expected to earn $19,000. Your study placed us 48 spots below Pittsburgh, while black children were actually better off here. So how do you explain that?
Yeah, that's right. Again, it's a matter of what statistics one wants to focus on. So when we did the 2014 study, we didn't have data on race and ethnicity at that point. We were using information just from anonymized tax return. In tax data, as you know, from filing your taxes, you don't have information on people's race and ethnicity. In subsequent work, we were able to link that data to data from the census, thereby allowing those breakdowns by race and ethnicity. And so at one level, it's a fact that Charlotte has significantly lower levels of economic mobility than Pittsburgh, if you just look at the communities as a whole. At another level, you're right that if you focus on specific subcommunities, like black children, as you pointed out, the differences could even go the other way. So that's why, in the new work, we're showing both sets of statistics, both pooling everyone and by subgroup. And the patterns that we're seeing, importantly, especially in the changes, as we discussed earlier on the show, are consistent across racial groups. Mm-hmm. Black kids are doing relatively better. White kids are doing relatively better growing up in low-income families in Charlotte relative to peer cities.
When Raj was here, Sherry, about a year ago to talk about this study as it was being released, the second one, he cautioned us not to look for quick results to these efforts that we're involved in right now. And then, in fact, we should be prepared to wait for decades. Well, we live in a world where people want results yesterday. You come from the business world, Sherry, where they measure progress by the quarter, mm-hmm. Not long term. And the effort that you are involved in with leading on opportunity is something that has to be measured long term. You have said that what you do is, quote, journey work, not destination work. So explain that and tell me what has to be done to allow you and others to hang in there and do the work and get the support you need for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate the question. It is indeed journey work. I think we've become notorious for saying that this work is not quarter over quarter, but quarter century over quarter century work. And that remains true. What we know here in Charlotte, and particularly in a finance and banking town, is that the numbers do matter. So we need some incentives to make sure that we continue doing that. So that's part of the reason that we created the Opportunity Compass. If we don't know in totality what this will result in 30 years from now, what can we measure that gives us some indication of the direction that we're going in? And so that's part of it. The other is encouraging an orientation shift, right? When we think about economic development, I have never heard anybody say, when are we going to be done with economic development? It's something we're constantly iterating on, that we're always looking for the next strategy or how to partner or collaborate or bring a new organization. Economic mobility, my hope is that our community would consider it in the same way. It is a condition that we consider and not something that we can check the box and be done with. And I know that that takes some shifting, but I think moving to that orientation would also help to better situate folks in what it looks like to continue this for the long term.
Raj.
To Sherry's point, I would underscore that economic development is not distinct From economic mobility, indeed, our work shows that economic mobility can be critical for economic development itself. So when we harness our talent in our communities and bring people through the pipeline, we have the talent to fill positions in businesses, to start new businesses, to make new discoveries that end up creating that vibrant economy that everyone wants. So these are not two distinct goals. I actually think the focus on creating economic opportunity is central for economic development. And it's a long-term game because the factors that matter start in childhood, and it really takes 20 years to play out and see those gains. Now, we recognize, exactly as you pointed out, Mike, that you can't tell a politician or a leader of a nonprofit, you know, make this change, we'll do a study 25 years from now, and you're going to be happy with the results. So we, you know, along the lines of what Sherry is doing and her team, are trying to identify earlier indicators of this long-term progress. What are some things you can look at, like test scores, maybe measures of social capital, maybe early health indicators that kind of give you a sign that you're on the right track? And our hope is by showing those progress on those early indicators and saying, you know, we've seen historically that this translates to long-term success that benefits all of us, that can be a motivator for the business community, for everyone to invest in these important issues that will pay off in future generations.
Things are interconnected. Nothing is in silos. Everything impacts everything. When you look at this study and other things that we've talked about over the years, your study makes an argument not just for the integration of our schools, but for the integration of our neighborhoods. I don't think overtly it makes that argument, but if you look at it, it's kind of saying that. The study shows that where you grow up has a huge influence on your life economically and otherwise. And if you grow up in communities where parents of your own race and class are unemployed or struggling to get ahead or to earn a living, that has an adverse impact on children's outcomes as they grow up. But on the other side, if children grow up in neighborhoods where families are working, where parents are working at higher rates, those children tend to do better as a result. Why and how long have we known that?
Yeah, so my sense is the mechanisms there have something to do with social capital, who you're connected to, who you're influenced by. So think about a couple of simple examples. If you're in a community where no one's gone to college, nobody's working, folks are struggling, you may not see a clear path for yourself. You may get discouraged. You may not have on your radar screen the ways that you could try to pursue these paths yourself. If in contrast, you're in a community where lots of folks have access to those opportunities in the prior generation themselves, you may get that internship. You may think about a career in technology or science or education or whatever it might be. And that ends up influencing kids' trajectories in important ways. So I think that's one important mechanism consistent with prior work that we've done on the importance of social capital and who people are connected to. That's a driver of what we're seeing here.
Let's talk about social capital. Go ahead, Sherry. I'll let you go first. Go ahead.
I was just going to respond to your question around how long have we known that social capital was important? And again, I come back to folks who known they didn't have it, have always known it was important. So, you know, my family, I've shared this often, I'm the product of the Great Migration. So my family in the 50s moved from rural Alabama to Detroit where they could earn income. And they also knew that they would be in neighborhoods where they could buy a home, where they could send their kids to school. That was true in the 50s. And it's true now in a lot of ways for what brings folks to Charlotte, right? Everyone talks about Charlotte as a great place to raise a family, despite some of the things that we talked about today. And so I think that when I, again, appreciate the work that Raj puts out, there are these things that folks know intuitively who've been experiencing this. Raj gives the language and data science to systematize that. So how can we create processes or structures within our nonprofit and government system, or even better, policy, such that those things are built into how we do things here in Charlotte and in the US, as opposed to whispers among those trying to figure it out or get access to it.
Let's talk about social capital, Sherry, for a second, because Charlotte ranked low in yet another study several years ago, around the time of the original Chetty study, that showed us lacking in social capital. In other words, although our workplaces are relatively integrated, when we go home at 5 o'clock, we tend to associate with those like ourselves. So there's not a lot of interconnectedness socially outside of the workplace. And you can't build social capital if you don't mix and mingle and learn about other people and know them. Things may have changed since that social capital study came out, but have we launched any response to that study that would help you in your efforts to the CHETI study? Sherry.
Well, we talked about here the importance of social capital in Charlotte. Much of the data that we have shared with our community highlights how the community ranked it as one of the most important things. And we also know that it is difficult to measure that well here in Mecklenburg County. So Raj now has a new Facebook data that he's using. But when we think about how to measure social capital with the publicly available data that we have, we don't really have measures available that reflect the research that Raj has put out. Certainly we could look at voter participation or civic engagement. But when it comes down to it, as you talked about, Mike, it's how are we in relationship with one another? How are we influencing what we're doing in our careers, which is how social capital is most lifted up? We have some spots, bright spots of where schools like the Northwest School of the Arts are doing that really well, but we haven't been able to do it at scale. And so now what Leading on Opportunity is doing as we prepare for the next iteration of the Compass is looking at, okay, what are the measures that are available to us? How can we include them in our Compass and then share those with others as they continue the work?
Raj, your new study says that Charlotte's improvement in economic mobility, quote, may be due in part to the prevalence of economic connectedness or the interaction between high, above median income people in low income communities and the likelihood low income people will form friendships with the high income people with whom they interact. Is that an indication to you that we are improving our social capital quotient, or that there is an upside to gentrification? Because that's where a lot of this is happening, where people from different backgrounds are meeting in the same area and living together.
Yeah. So our work, both in this study and, you know, prior research, shows using Facebook data, as Sherry mentioned earlier, that economic connectedness, the extent to which low and high income people are friends with each other, basically are connected to each other, is the strongest predictor of economic mobility. And our sense is the way we interpret these recent findings that changes in parental employment rates have influenced kids' outcomes is through that same lens. Kids are more likely to be growing up in communities, especially Black kids, in communities where folks are working, where they're connected to people who might point them to opportunities and so on. Now, what does that mean in terms of policy, in terms of important issues like gentrification? I see gentrification as something that basically has potential to actually create opportunity in some cases if done right, but typically it's not. So if gentrification just means that some people get displaced and lose their community, right, and essentially lose social capital, that could just be a negative. But if you have higher income folks, more, you know, folks with education, folks with access to opportunities who come into a community and you're still able to maintain access to housing, affordable housing, maintain connections between the prior residents to those new folks, that can actually create opportunities for people. Now, the challenge is that's usually very hard to do. People end up getting priced out and communities go in a different direction. But that's something I think Charlotte and other cities should really keep an eye on going forward.
I only have a couple minutes left here, Sherry, but it strikes me that many people don't know what Leading on Opportunity does. So I want to give you a moment to talk about what it is that you do. And I know that one of the reasons you, when you came here and took over, your job was to get that organization's house in order. So what do you do, and do you do it better today than you did when you first arrived?
Really quick response to what Raj said. When we think about gentrification versus social capital, it's all about the relationship. So proximity without relationship, gentrification. Proximity with relationship, social capital. So the 2040 plan is a phenomenal example of how we're trying to create opportunities for folks to own housing in areas they typically would not have afforded, which will create opportunities for relationships in schools, grocery stores, parks, et cetera. So I want to speak to that. In terms of Leading on Opportunity, Leading on Opportunity is an initiative at Foundation for the Carolinas. We are chiefly responsible for maintaining Charlotte's commitment to economic mobility by creating strategy, policy and data for funders to help them make smarter investments in economic mobility, and for nonprofits to help them deliver the strongest programming possible. And one of the tools we're most known for is our Opportunity Compass, which can be found on leadingonopportunity.org, which speaks to how we're doing now and gives you specific strategies for how to impact and involve yourself in the journey of economic mobility here in Charlotte.
And we'll leave it with your elevator speech. Thank you very much. Sherry Chisholm, the Executive Director of Leading on Opportunity. And we've had the pleasure of spending the hour with Raj Chetty, Professor of Economics at Harvard University, Director of Opportunity Insights, and the guy behind the Chetty Study, Land of Opportunity. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.